So my name is Ben Hassett. I'm the president and founder of B.E. Hassett Millwrights. It's a company I started in January 1st, 2001. I started my company after a four-year apprenticeship with a British millwright. And my story kind of begins in Iowa, and that's what I'll be going through today with my presentation here. Typically when I talk to a group, I have the luxury of having a mill as the backdrop where I stand in front of a water wheel, just show off my work, take, bow, take a pause, and that sort of thing. But what I'll be doing is kind of giving you the kind of a rundown of the scope and scale on which I operate, because I'm one of the really basically two millwrights in the country. A millwright being somebody that restores mills, whether they're grist mills, sawmills, woolen mills, and in the traditional sense, they're usually powered by wind or water. I restored the Wolfpin Mill, I believe in 2012, and then upon the completion of the project, the owner, Sally Bingham, asked me to if I was interested in relocating to Louisville to operate the mill and then manage the conservation property. And for our family, it was a great opportunity to live near a mill that I worked on, be able to share it. And kind of as we go through the slides I have today, you'll see kind of how I'm developing. I've been doing this for 21 years. It's kind of hard. I mean, it's the kind of the elephant in the room is I'm 40. I turned 40. But I started when I was 19. I got a huge interest in mills, and I'll kind of advance through here. So this is the Wolfpin Mill. It's located on Wolfpin Branch, and it was originally the original construction date. There's a little bit of a gray area around it, but we believe it was actually constructed in the 1850s. And the conservation property that Wolfpin Mill sits on, there's also another mill site there called Bergemeyer Mills, which was constructed in the 1820s, which was a series of mills, a grist mill, a sawmill, a saloon, a blacksmith shop. This was upstream from that mill complex as well. So when I originally started, a lot of the components inside are actually date from the 1870s, and those were all retained and refurbished. So when you come to the mill today, you'll still see that 1870s componentry in use. So Wolfpin Mill is kind of the anchor of the Wolfpin Branch watershed area. And Wolfpin Branch is named after, in the early pioneer days, as I've learned, is that there was wolves were trapped in pens along the branch. And if you walk Wolfpin Branch, which starts up right around 71, around where Cabela's is now, and Norton Hospital, and it runs down through Wolfpin Branch Road, and two-thirds of Wolfpin Branch run on the boundary of the farm, the conservation farm, and it runs into Harrod's Creek. So the oral history and lore is that the pioneers would build these pens along the branch on steep terrain, and they would use these bait boards, a cantilevered bait board, and build, I think they're about 9 by 9 pens that would be built on steep terrain. And there'd be a pivoted board, almost like a diving board. And then at the far end of the board, they would hang a piece of meat or some sort of bait. And the men would kind of come out, set the bait, and then the next morning they'd go back and kind of finish off any wolves that were in the pen. And if you walk Wolfpin Branch, there's two different areas along that stream where that terrain kind of fits that description. And that's right at the base of the waterfall where the mill's sited, and then about 100 feet down where there's another small waterfall in that same area. So that's the basic namesake of Wolfpin Branch. Wolfpin Branch Mill all comes from that early history. So my story really began in Iowa when I was 19. This is the Danish windmill. It's an 1846 Danish smock windmill. It's 5 stories tall. It has 68-foot sails. The cap on the top, this is called the cap. This actually rotates into the wind so it can turn and operate. These sails will get going in between 6 revolutions and 10 revolutions, and at 68 feet, it's a pretty massive amount of power. And that's what really drew me to this profession is to kind of go there and witness this 160, 170-year-old technology in operation. And I met a gentleman that was working on it. He was British, and he was finishing off some of the restoration work that actually began in the 1970s. So just to kind of tell you a little bit about the structure itself is these sails are 68 feet tip to tip. They're shuttered sails as opposed to what are called common sails that you'll see on a lot of Dutch windmills in English mills where they have canvas that's furled out. These shutters actually open and close, and that's a 1785 invention. That's how old that technology is, and they're called patent sails. And patent sails help regulate the speed of the mill because wind, as opposed to water mill, where you have a steady stream of water and you can operate at a consistent speed, wind gusts. So you need to somehow try to control that and try to help kind of even out the power and speed of the mill. So they would come up with these different types of either spring regulated or weight regulated shuttered sails called patent sails. And here at the Danish windmill, it was a rack and pinion. There's actually a rod that goes all the way through from the backside of the mill to the front, and there's an endless chain you can kind of see coming up and down here. And if you pull on the chain, it actually, just like a set of blinds, will close the shutters and allows the mill to turn on. And you can hang a weight on the chain, and it helps balance out the speed of the mill or regulate the speed of the mill through just a counterweight. And I think I started learning about mills and learning about how there's two doors. There's a door on one side of the mill and a door on the other. And they did that because if the sails were turning and they needed to get out and do maintenance or any sort of repair, they could still get out. And so there's all these little things that are really just simple that evolved over time because they needed to. All these little mechanisms, all these little mechanical mechanisms for regulating speed, balance, access, egresses. The shape of the body of this tower is 5 stories tall. This mechanism, this fantail here, it catches the wind. And so if the wind shifts directions when the sails aren't facing into the wind, it will actually turn this wheel here, and there's a series of drive shafts that come into a ring gear that will actually face the mill into the wind. So this whole setup up here weighs about 35,000 pounds. And it is on a very crude cast bearing that it actually turns around on. And so with mills, windmills, and I'll show you a couple other different types of mills, that's imperative that you can face the mill into the wind so it can operate, and also quarter it so if you have huge 60 mile an hour gusts, you can kind of quarter it and stop it from turning too. So there's a couple different ways to keep a windmill from turning. One is a giant brake wheel. I'm constructing a brake wheel in my shop, which is probably about 2 or 3 miles away from here right now for this mill. So I started here 21 years ago, and December 27th, I actually took all this apart. And I'm starting the reconstruction process. So next May, I'll actually be reinstalling these new sails. These sails are actually single-piece timbers, and you'll see photographs of them. They're 68-foot timbers that I had sawn out in Oregon, and then they came down the interstate to our shop here on Frankfort and Melwood Avenue. But the interesting thing about the sails is this is about 6,000 pounds of weight hanging outside the footprint of the building. So you see that wider base at the bottom and the narrow base at the top. And so the sails actually sit at about a 12 to 15 degree angle to help thrust the weight of the sails back towards the center of the tower. And what that does is allow, if they were horizontal, if the shaft was horizontal, the tendency would be for when the wind hit it to pull the shaft up and pull it through the roof. And so they knew the physics behind, they developed really understood the physics behind how to set all this machinery, these massive weights, and keep them rotating and keep them in place. And so that's where the trade of mill riding developed. And the first mills date from the 2nd century BC, and that over time evolved into a pretty developed and evolved trade in understanding of a lot of natural sciences. The other feature about the sails, and this is something I'm going to be doing starting next month, is these 68-foot sails, because the body has a sweep to it, so you can kind of have a wider footprint to keep the weight closer to the center of the to, of the of the of the tower. These sails are actually bent so that when they turn around, they miss the building. And so one of the issues with this sail, the rear sail, was rotted out the back, and it actually shifted towards the back. And now, just when during the dismantling process, when we turned it around, it would actually hit the building. So they quit operating this about 18 months ago. Had they operated it and the wind gusted in shifted directions, the sail would have actually impacted the structure. And there's also gift shops. There's what historically would have been a granary attached to the base of the tower. There's now a gift shop. So you have people working. This is in this very small town in Iowa that has a population of less than 700 people. It was brought over from Denmark in 1976. And the whole lore and history behind this windmill is that when they brought it over, it was in bad shape when they took it down. That's just why they sold it. And they said they say there's no longer any rotten wood in Denmark because it all ended up in Elkhorn. So that's how my mentor got involved with this project, with this mill and this project, and that's how I'm still involved with it today, is kind of bringing it back up to where it needs to be to function and grind grain. So the Elkhorn, Iowa, has the largest concentration of Danish ancestry in the country. There's the Danish Museum is a couple blocks away. And it's just this tiny little town, nicest people in the world. And you go to all the different restaurants there, you go to the grocery store, that sort of thing. It's all Danish food. Yeah, all their sandwiches are served open-faced there. There's these type of dried meats that you just don't find anywhere else, like roll pulse and all this sort of thing. So there's Ebelskiver. They don't have pancakes, they have Ebelskiver. So you just go there, and there's this little piece of Danish culture in Iowa. And they've actually had a documentary, I won't call it reality TV, but they have a documentary on PBS that had a series of four shows, and they're all kind of celebrities. There's a webcam in Elkhorn, and there's drinking games in Denmark when a car drives by on Main Street, because it's such a small town that people take a shot. So it's a pretty funny culture up there, and they make buying trips. Their gift shop is fantastic. They make buying trips to Denmark, and the mayor of Elkhorn is a celebrity in Denmark. He met with the U.S. ambassador when he goes over there. It's just kind of like, it's a really interesting culture and setup. And most of the mills I work with are all surrounded by these communities. And historically, mills were always a gathering place, and today they still are. And so when I came out here to Louisville, I've tried to engage the surrounding neighborhoods and all as well, and open the mill up at Sally's request to kind of share the history of the mill and the mill itself and the land surrounding it with neighbors and community members. So that was really one of the biggest draws that I had to move from Virginia, where I lived for 19 years, to Louisville a couple of years ago. And so this is the mill when I was in Iowa and met my future mentor. This was the project when I moved to Virginia I worked on for 2 years. And this is a 1790s mill in Northern Virginia, just outside of Winchester, Virginia. It's called the Burwell Morgan Mill. The stonework, it's an interior water wheel. That's a 20-foot wheel. All the stonework was built by Hessian prisoners of war after the Revolution. And there's this incredible history. I came from Iowa, where I grew up in a Victorian neighborhood, but that was the earliest history, apart from Lewis and Clark, that was kind of the earliest history I had. So when I came out here, I was surrounded by everything I learned in the history books when I moved out to Virginia. And this is a 11-foot six gear. It's the first gear I built. This was all built by a 20-year-old. It's an 8,000-pound water wheel. It's interior. It's one of the only mills you'll go to that you can actually see the whole gear train and the water wheel work at the same time. There's usually a partition wall, but they intentionally left the partition wall down here so you could see the whole works, like the whole gear train in action with the water power. And there's 11-foot six gear, 7-foot gears, 3-foot gears. This is the clutch. So you would slide this whole shaft in assembly, which probably weighs 5,000 pounds or so, slides with this lever into an engagement with the rounds and the teeth. And that's what allows you to turn the mill off and on when you shut the water off, and then you can disengage and run different things. So this is a huge lesson for me and my mentor at the time, he was getting up there, and when I approached him about apprenticing him, he said, "Oh, I'm retiring. I'm not going to do it." But he kept taking on work, so I ended up moving out there and working for a really reasonable rate. This was all built, $9 an hour. So it was that's not what he charged them, but it's a 2-year project for me, where I had the opportunity to really learn about the fundamentals, the material science, on a different level that I value and appreciate, and kind of carry forward with me. And the people that work for me too, I kind of try to not talk about, well, we just make lines here and cut this and turn square pieces into round pieces, but this is why we do it. This is the species we're using. This is the characteristics of the species that we use and why. And I usually start with loggers, how I source my materials. I consult for a lot of different museum and projects around the country, everywhere from the Hudson River Valley in New York out to California. And I have a network of different sawmills and vendors where I can get really hard to find items in materials. A lot of the timbers that are used to make up the arc sections of the water wheel, they'll be 20 inches wide, 4 inches thick, they weigh 200 pounds, and it's all white oak. And white oak has to air dry, so a 3-inch white oak board, which is what most of this gearing and wheel are assembled from, the lead time is years, because it has a closed cell structure, which is why it's used for coopering and storage, is that water doesn't penetrate into it. But when a tree is standing, it has free water and bound water in it, but it loses volume as it dries. So you can't build gears and wheels and different things with green wood, because it just shrinks, it twists, it warps, and nothing would be accurate, everything would break apart. So I have a good network of sourcing materials and knowing about what species to use where and what's interchangeable and what's not. There's different woods you use for gear teeth versus the shafts. All these shafts here are single timbers. They're hewed down. They're face down into, 6, 12, 20-sided timbers. That's a 28-inch log. It's 20 feet long, 28 inches across the flats, has 20 sides on it. It's a 5,000-pound piece of wood. It comes in through a little door on the far side. So when they constructed these mills, they would start with, they'd find a stream. They'd see where they could develop the water power for the size and volume of work they were wanting to produce, and then design the structure around it. They would start with the stream, design the mechanics, and then the structure around it was just a cover. But there's very specific little openings. You can look at the forensics of a mill. I go in and reconstruct a lot of different drivetrains and elements of mills all around the country, and I'll start with nothing. I'll start with a dirt floor. But there'll be cutouts in stone. And through a couple decades of experience, I know that nobody quarried out stone for no reason at all. There was some reason for it. So you'll go in there, you'll kind of examine the site, look at the forensics, you'll find out where the center lines fall. You have your tailwater at the base of the mill site. You'll have your elevations from your mill dam or stream that kind of set the top and bottom height, and that will tell you how big your water wheel can be, how much power you can develop from the site. And kind of what I say is that the early pioneers, when they came out to Wolfpin Branch or the Prospect area or up in Lancaster, Ohio, where Rock Mill is they looked at what they could work with to develop the most amount of power. So they would look for natural waterfalls, and they'd walk the streams, and they'd be able to listen and hear where that power was coming from. If you can hear rushing water, you have a lot of drop to a stream. And then it's amazing if you go through USGS surveys and you find the lowest lying point on a stream and the greatest amount of fall on a stream, there was a mill there. I mean, there was mills all over the place. In Virginia, the average county had 60 mills in a county. And they would do that because, it's pre-refrigeration, pre-electricity. They had to, before they could consume their grains, it had to be processed. And so they had to be within a close ride, and there was no electricity for sawmills. Everything had to be, within a reasonable drive. But that was all dictated by the waterways and where that power could come from. The layout of windmills in North America, you'll see windmills up and down the East Coast. You don't see any windmills in Kentucky. but you see them in Virginia, North Carolina, Long Island, and then you see them out in Iowa, in the Great Plains, all the way up and down the Illinois, Kansas, Texas, because they have the prevailing winds. Just how the wind turbines and generators are sited now, that's where the historical mills were, too. And it's pretty impressive. There's very few windmills left because it wasn't a perfect science. It was, you know, you're depending on the wind. Your whole life revolved around the wind. And windmills or water mills always kind of superseded windmills in areas where they could utilize water power because it was consistent. So I'll advance to my next slide here. So I'm going to take you through a year in my life in terms of projects, and I'll if you have any questions, just stop me, and I'll try to explain any part of the slide that I'm showing. But one of the things when you hear about what I do, it seems, well, that's interesting. It's an interesting craft. And that's how my mentor operated. He operated on an artisan level. He was British. He had practiced for 50 years. He moved to the U.S. in the 70s for a couple different projects and ended up staying. And he had what we call an artistic temperament, where he was like really, as a apprentice, like I'd sit down in meetings with our clients and different things. I'd sit down, and he would get up, stand down, getting in conflicts with his client about, you know, kind of taking off. I'm like, oh, this won't fit. You find somebody else to finish the project. I'm the only one, and all that sort of stuff. So I witnessed that, and I kind of took that, and I was like, you know, this is ridiculous. All these things are disappearing so quickly. We need to do something about this. And that's how I've developed my approach to restoration. In that project I showed, the Burwell Morgan project, when it was built in the 1990s, had a certain amount of, 20 years have gone by. I can actually do that same project for less. And I do that because of the scale and scope on which I work, which is I do a lot of work. And you're going to see this through this series of slides. And any questions you have, just ask. But this is the Robertson Windmill at Colonial Williamsburg. This is a windmill that was actually reconstructed in the 1950s off of a 1650s windmill in Cambridge, England. And so the windmill in Cambridge was original. It had lived its life. It had all of its repairs and failures, and then, you know, quick repairs to kind of keep the mill running. And when this was drawn out in the 50s, it was actually, there was a lot of repairs and different things incorporated into the design. There was major structural elements were missing. Some of the different things that they used in England to kind of keep the mill limping along were integrated into the new construction. And so it was always an issue that the mill wasn't operating the way it should. There was a what they call head sick and tail sick. This is a post windmill, where the Danish windmill is a smock windmill, where the cap rotates around on a top on a tower. This actually is called a post windmill, where it sits on a single post, and the whole structure, this whole structure here, which is 10 feet wide and 16 feet long and 20 feet tall, that actually all sits on a massive post, and the whole structure turns into the wind. And that's just that so, hey, same concept in turning the cap and the fantail, turning the sails into the wind. That's what the post windmill does. So my scope of service on the project was to kind of evaluate the structure, help to solve some of the balance issues, because you got a 30,000 pounds, 35,000 pounds balancing on a post, and it needs to turn into the wind, and then you have 55-foot sails on it, which catches the wind, and it tends to sag and turn and bind. So I had to kind of analyze that and kind of come up with a fix for it. So that's what I did. I set out to do in May 2015, which is, ironically, I moved to Kentucky. I didn't have much work in Virginia in probably 2013, 2014. I was working here in Kentucky. I was working up in Pennsylvania. As soon as we decided to move to Louisville, like, I had two huge projects in Virginia. And so I was commuting back to Colonial Williamsburg for about 4 or 5 months after we moved here. It was really... My wife was really happy. But Williamsburg is a great place to visit, too. So you can kind of see some of the different elements I've added. This is a new wind shaft. And you can see, when I was talking about the shaft and the sail sitting up at an angle, that's what this wind shaft does, is it's sits up at about a 15-degree angle to help thrust the weight back to the center of the structure towards the back so that the sails don't tip over and flip down through the roof. You can see the millstones in there. We pretty much took the roof off, shored up the frame, and then replaced most of the major structural elements in there, installing this 20x20 main support and these 10x18 supports to help carry the weight. So the weight's distributed. It goes up from a single point. There's this big 20x20 timber that spans the width of the building, and then the weight of the building is then carried out to the four corners of the structure for balance. So when it was constructed in the 1950s, this piece was missing. So all the balance was off center, so it would drag. It'd be head sick and tail sick is what they call it. If the mill lists forward, it's called head sick. If it lists towards the back, it's called tail sick. And so this is my little effect, yeah. Hey, yeah, hey. So now you can see the mill back on its post, which is called the trestle. And so we, part of the process with working with Matt Webster, who's the director of historic resources at Colonial Williamsburg, is we wanted to re-authenticate what the mill was. Previously, the mill in the 1950s, everything was painted white. And that's not how they appeared. They were tarred. And so we did this really, because this was moved out of the historic area because they couldn't authenticate where the mill actually was sited, they moved it to what they call Great Hope Farm. And so when you come out of the visitor center across the footbridge that walks you back in time, this is the first thing you see now. If you were there before November 2015, you didn't see the mill because it was on cribbing and they left the trees up so people couldn't see it. And then as soon as we were done with the project, they actually removed some trees so we get some wind and have a view shed and trails to access the site, because it was previously basically like a maintenance area, and now it's been opened up and kind of incorporated into the interpretive area. So one of the first things I built in my new shop in Louisville was this ladder. Now the ladder actually is hinged. It's pivoted. This actually, in later photos, you can see more of the apparatus that hangs off the base of the mill. But there's a giant 32-foot pole that runs from the center of the building out the back, and that's like a lever, like a rudder lever, that you can turn the whole structure on. And so I have some pictures towards the end of the show where you'll see myself and my daughter and two of her friends turning the building. They're a huge help. So, but you can see the trestle, and this is one of the earliest forms of windmill on the European continent, where windmills actually evolved around the 1100s in Syria, in Iraq, and they would use land winds there, and they would build a vertical post windmill, would have sails kind of coming off of it, and they would build up some walls, almost in the shape of a turbine housing, that would catch the wind, move it around that center axis, and then carry power out. So they believe that during the Crusades, that through stories was conveyed back to Europe, and they said, well, it's a mill like your water mills, which were already in existence. So they set the shaft on a horizontal axis as opposed to a vertical axis. That's just kind of the thought process, or at least the theory behind where this happened. So they very early realized for them to actually use this wind and use this power, they would have to face the structure into the wind. And so they would start by building these like primitive structures, these little, I refer to these as barns on sticks to like try to interpret that to people, because it's a building on a central post. But they would, initially what they would do is they'd lop off a big tree that was set in the ground. They'd run braces down to the ground and build the structure on top of it. So they just use a standing tree and then build the structure on top of it so it could be spun into the wind. And so that evolved over time, over several centuries, where they elevated, they actually took the tree down, dried it, brought it up off the ground so it wasn't rotting and decaying and toppling over. And they'd set it on piers, and then this is this trestle. Every element of a windmill and a watermill has a specific name because it has a specific purpose. And so you have, these are called cross trees. These are quarter bars. That's your main post. There's beams that, and the Dutch even take it another level further. They have in negative space, like spaces in between gearing and different things, they have a specific name for those. It's because it's such a big part of their culture. But this post-windmill spins around. There's a little ladder off the back that raises and lowers. It's white oak and locust. It's tarred. We used what I call a down east finish, and it's a combination of linseed oil, turpentine, and pine tar. So it's a slick resistant, skid resistant finish, and it smells good. It smells when you go out there. It's like a colonial sort of feel to it. And so this is with the sails on. They're 55 foot sails. They're pitch pine. It's basically an extinct species of wood that I sourced, and we made the new sails from. And you can see the tail pole there. There's the ladder, and there's a pole going out the back. That's what you use to turn the whole thing into the wind. And as the mill operated in the 50s, they're having issues with operating the mill because where it was sited, it didn't have a lot of wind. So they tried different things, like they had a 4-foot set of millstones inside, and they shrank it down to 36-inch stones. But then they left the casing and the furniture the size for a 4-foot stone. So we did different things to, side, right? We basically reconstructed the casing that went around the millstones using the original stuff. We just shrunk everything down. So it was more, we re-authenticated everything so it's functional and kind of fits its intended purpose. So, and that was November, and I kind of skipped a couple months, but this is probably January and February 2016. This is actually a newly constructed mill, and you'll see I have a rare opportunity to work on not just historic mills, but there's a lot of interest in that water power technology. So this is actually a nature center and preserve in the Southern Ozarks. It's called Dogwood Canyon. And it's owned by the owner of Bass Pro Shops. He owns the whole place. It seems like he owns all of Southern Missouri. But it's a beautiful canyon. And they have, I think, like 3,000 acres there, and you can go on guided tours, Segway tours, and different things. But the infrastructure there was decaying when it was built before he purchased it. So he constructed this massive mill / gift shop / restaurant. And it's an amazing, like, you know, the 1% of the budget was my gristmill stuff, but it's pretty impressive to see. I'm used to working on historic structures, and then you go to like basically a commercial site where you have 40 people, like the Treehouse Masters were there. It was just kind of like a pretty wild experience. And what I did is if I have the opportunity to work or build a new mill, I'll take it just because it's a learning experience for me. Because I get involved with designs from the stream up. Here, they went out of control. There's actually they integrated in a 120 foot waterfall, and on the backside of it, it's not like a little tiny trickle of a stream. It's like a river was like dropping over the. It's kind of amazing. And so this is the mill pond, and all the water actually flows over into the tail race. And so this is a 26-foot metal wheel. I used basically salvaged components that somebody else had salvaged from a mill that was dismantled. I purchased those, refurbished them, and created a drivetrain to power their machinery and mechanics. So it's a new mill, but if the mechanics that somebody has salvaged, I won't salvage mechanics myself out of a mill. It's just a something I don't do. But if they're available for sale and I have a project like this, I'll purchase them. Like millstones, people pull millstones out of collapsed structures and different things, and I'll evaluate them and put them back to use if they're usable. If I know the condition that they're in, and I can refurbish them. So that's what happened here. Is I created this drivetrain, and we powered a set of millstones. And so it kind of expands the education of and exposes it to the technology of mills to a different market. And what you can see here is this is actually all original, probably 1920s milling machinery. This was from Franklin County, Virginia. It was actually on a show called Salvage Dogs, which is Black Dog Salvage in Roanoke, Virginia. They're an architectural salvage company, and they, as part of their programming, asked me to come down and evaluate this thing that they had salvaged, which was Franklin County, Virginia, is like the capital of moonshining in Virginia, in probably the country. And this wasn't in a mill. It was in a corrugated steel shack in somebody's backyard, and it was powered off a tractor. And yes, it was a mash mill. And so what we did is after they took that shack down because it was the whole area was being cleared for development, they took it down to their shop and they came asked me to come down and evaluate it. And I gave them this whole spiel. They had their cameras running and I was talking about the science of millstones and dress patterns and composition of stones. And the stones came from Brush Mountain. It was the last and largest commercially operating millstone quarry in the country. And it came from probably 10 miles, right outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, right outside of Virginia Tech. That's where that millstone quarry was. And I talked about the significance of it. And when the program came out, I gave them a half hour of like information about millstones and what all this stuff did and where it came from. And when it came out, the sound man came up and said, oh, thank you. It was a great education. Thank you for doing all this sort of stuff. And when it came out on the program, it was like me on there for 10 seconds saying, oh, it's worth $4,500. So I ended up buying it and then incorporating it into this project out in the Missouri Ozarks. So you can see there's the functioning grist mill. We have this is a meal bin, a black walnut meal bin from Indiana. This is a Miller's desk from Pennsylvania. And then I constructed the way they laid out this grist mill, because it was the entrance to the gift shop. They left the loft areas visible so you could see the conveyance of meal and grain throughout the whole structure. So the one of the big aspects of a mill and why the buildings are sized the way they are, the actual footprint of the structure, is based on the volume of grain that they grind. It's not an arbitrary just footprint of a building. They're like, they need to store so many tons of grain. It's going to need to go up to the third floor so it can be cleaned and then go into the millstones through gravity, through spouts and different apparatus. But to get the grain up to the cleaners, it uses a set of elevators. And these are belt and cup elevators that are basically take a couple pounds of grain and convey it up every foot up to the upper floors. And so here you could actually see all the different elevators, all the different cleaners, and all the different sifting apparatus in operation all at the same time. So you just walk in, you look up three floors, and then go get your ticket. So now this is the second water wheel I built here in Louisville. This is at Haygood Mill. Some of these slides are actually videos, but when I tried to play the video, it turned sideways. So we're gonna just look at the picture. So so this is a 22-foot white oak water wheel. It's 5 feet wide. It's down in Pickens County. It's outside of Greenville, South Carolina. It has an 18-foot gear mounted to it. And it really, I'll step back here so you can see, okay. And we also constructed 97 feet of flume. So the flume is the built structure that carries the water to the top of the wheel. And then you have a series of gates that help regulate the speed of the mill, just the way the shutters and cloth on windmill sails regulate the speed of the windmill. The gates and the volume of water going onto the wheel is what regulates the speed of the water mill. So you'll have bypasses, you'll have a control gate, a bypass gate, that allows the wheel to operate at a set speed, and anything additional gets dumped out the side. So it's like the basically the battery or the power source is all kind of coming down the flume, and you just regulate with your gates and your load. Okay. Now this is Rock Mill. This is a project that. I started in 2012. This was a private property that was donated to a park network in Fairfield County, Ohio. It's an amazing site. It's just a phenomenal site. And if you're ever up west of Columbus, Ohio, I'd recommend stopping by there because it is just spectacular. This is a covered bridge. This is a 35-foot gorge. This is actually a 14-foot waterfall, and the first mill was built here in the 1790s. And what they did to develop the power, again, it's kind of going back to the site. This was the perfect site to develop water power. The stream came through the gorge, and it kind of worked its way down there over the years, and it's 8 feet wide there. So what they did is they actually quarried to build the dam to give them an operating head. They quarried grooves in the side of the gorge and dropped logs in it and created a dam. That's all it took. And so then they quarried a head race through the stone. and then brought it over and turned it over the wheel. And this is a 26-foot diameter oak wheel. It's the largest hardwood wheel in the country. It's not the largest water wheel by far, but one of the largest hardwood oak wheels. And so when we started there, there was this quarried channel that you could see where the dam was. The structure was completely empty. Most of the siding was off of it. It's 6 stories tall. 2 of the levels, like from here down, are actually built into the side of the gorge face. So they're almost like caves more than rooms. You can see that there was framed openings for windows here. And when I was originally brought in, we were told that the wheel was 26 feet in diameter, and myself and an engineer did a survey of the site, and we're like, there's no way there's a 26 foot, there's not enough clearance from where your water is to the bedrock to actually fit. And what happened is that we thought it was only going to be a 24 foot wheel, and that the oral history was wrong, because I've worked on mills where I build a 20 foot wheel and there'll be a newspaper article that come out and it'll be a 24 foot wheel. So that happens. But what during the repair process of repairing the gorge sidewall and putting the siding and windows back in, is they were power washing the bedrock for the foundations for the scaffolding. It was 96 feet tall, the scaffolding was. And when they were power washing, they found this cutout. And so where we thought the wheel sat from the photographic evidence that we had, it was actually 7 feet closer to the waterfall. So and that actually allowed for a 26-foot wheel to go in there. So we put the 26-foot wheel in there. And it's pretty amazing. There's also another slide where you can see water going over the wheel. A 26-foot wheel will operate up to 10 revolutions a minute, and it's an amazing amount of speed, an amazing amount of power. It's balanced to the point where when I first put it up and I have video of it, like, you know, a 12-year-old can come up and pull it and it would turn. And we always, when I install gear trains on mills, the before you add water, which isn't really that controllable, you actually have to get inside the wheel and walk it around like a hamster. So that's a fun, it's a little job perk. So I'm kind of going through my year. So everything we saw from Colonial Williamsburg, which is May through November of 2015, this is a project that I actually worked on in 2005. It's in Monterey County, California. It's the Challenge Doublehead Wind Engine. And what it is this is a what they call a wind engine, a power motor. And it has 30-foot wheels, back to back, counter-rotating wheels, and there's 10-foot side wheels. And it's the same premise as the windmill has to face into the wind. So these 10-foot wheels will catch the wind and spin that whole thing around on a tower. So the tower actually comes in and goes down through the building. This is 30 foot in diameter. From the sill to the eaves is also 30 feet. So the engine's the same size as the building. And this turns at 25 revolutions a minute, and it weighs 10,000 pounds. And when you're in it, it rattles, and I mean, the whole building shakes. And it powers all sorts of mill machinery in this building, and then there's a covered beltway that goes into a woodworking shop. This was a wheelwright shop. And this actually predates the windmill building and structure. Duncan McKinnon, who built this complex, went to the World Expo in 1892 in Chicago, and this is what he came back with. So he had it shipped out in rail car, and then everything else was built to accommodate this. And when this was reconstructed in 2004 and 2005, this is the last one in existence. There were 6 of these originally produced. And what they did during that time of Victorian technology, when, you know, they had all sorts of kind of science quackery and medical quackery, and what they did with these windmills is they would take a windmill, a premise that worked well in like a 12-foot or 15-foot or 18-foot windmill, and they just made it bigger. And so that's what they did here, is they kind of supersized the windmill. And it was just, it's impressive, but it's not, having two wheels on it doesn't equal double the horsepower. It's just more of a flywheel effect. But there's 1,400 slats in these wheels. And there's like 6,000 rivets and different things holding stuff together. It's an extremely complex machine, for as simple as it is. There's a lot of moving parts to it. And they have to be inspected. This is 20 miles from the Pacific Ocean. So there's corrosion, there's different things that happen to it. And so once we got it up there and got everything operating, they're like, well, we need to inspect this. So I go out there. That's how tough my life is. I go out to Monterey County, California a couple times a year, climb up and grease everything, inspect everything, and operate. Usually they have groups. We last time I was out there, which was in November, I met with a group of bakers in the area. And they were really trying to produce a genuine Salinas Valley sourdough. And so they needed the grains. And so when I went in, and there's a series of elevators, there's all weather belts in there. There's a few of them I was able to recondition and put back into use. But the belt and cup elevators were original. And so what I was able to do is pull the cup away from the belt, and I was able to get a handful of grain. I got oats, barley, and wheat. And they were able to develop three different cultures from the stuff that I handed them. I handed them like eight or nine berries and oats and grain, and they took it and they were able to cultivate these three different yeasts from it, and it was pretty cool. So they said next time I go out there, they're going to give me a loaf of bread. So, and this is again the second water wheel I built here in Louisville. This was about this time last year is when we were doing the installation. This is that 22-foot by 5-foot wheel. It gives you the idea of the scale of you can see my helpers in there.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's how big it is. And it's a really beautiful wheel. There's tie rods that help hold it together. It's pretty spectacular. We reused the existing axle, which is actually a locomotive axle that had been repurposed on cast hubs. So we kind of kept all that as much as the original as we could. The old wheel had actually fallen apart and was collapsing into the building. Now they need to work on the building, but they got a really nice, beautiful wheel. So, yeah. And when I got back from that trip, we had our first, one of our first open days at the mill, at Wolfpin Mill Farm. And we invited all the families from the neighborhood to kind of come down, see the mill in operation, kind of with a focus on the kids. So there was activities for the kids to kind of come out and see. They were able to use a mortar and pestle and you know, muddle corn into cornmeal and time it and shell the corn and see the mill and get an idea. They had a lot of fun. They got to bag their own cornmeal and make a big mess. So it was good. And that's how we're kind of evolving our mission out there, is to kind of slowly develop a program organically with neighborhood groups and schools to bring people in and share it. But my role at the property, which is 430 acres, is to bring the whole property into a sustainable level. And that, and we get income from rental houses, and we have a lot of fields, we have a lot of forest. And it's just kind of bringing a maintenance concept in and creating a budget to operate from based on the rental, so that this beautiful property that's been preserved, it's really in a concentrated area of development right now. And we just want to make sure that it kind of continues into the future. And that's what we're laying the groundwork for. And part of that is the grist mill. It's kind of what started it. The restoration of the grist mill kind of really started the restoration of the farm. So since I've moved onto the property, we're on our fourth house renovation out there, and it's just kind of working through. We're going to be working on barns and different things through the year, and working with even developers upstream. They know what we have. The mill sits in the middle of Wolfpin Branch. The Wolfpin watershed is all the neighborhoods around. It's Norton Commons. It's the Norton Hospital. It's Lowe's, it's Cabela's, they all feed into Wolfpin, and it all goes right by the mill. And so that we've actually engaged with the developers upstream when they're planning to put new buildings in. We meet and we talk about it. And we work through different scenarios. They're doing dye tests and different things to kind of gauge the runoff of what's kind of going into the stream. So it's kind of more than I thought I was going to be involved with when I came out here, but it's definitely an evolving and very educational experience for me. So at the end of May, after we had our open day, I started my gear building project for Rock Mill. This is a 14-foot face gear. It's the primary drive gear off that 26-foot water wheel. And this is all built in the shop here in Louisville. And later that month, this is another mill, this furniture. So you have millstones here. This is a 48-inch set of millstones. You can see the groove pattern in the face. That's called the dress of the millstones. There's actually a whole science behind the groove pattern that goes into stones. It has to do with the composition, the grain being ground, and the direction of rotation. So everything here is directional. These furrows are depth to the type of grain, whether it's corn or whether it's wheat or barley, whatever you're grinding. These furrows are actually depth and cut specifically for a type of grain. Part of the process of grinding creates heat from the friction, and then the grain imparts oil to the process. So there's a lot of maintenance on millstones. You have to usually dress your stones if you're grinding on a regular basis once a year. Because what happens is the stones actually get polished, and you have to work through and kind of chip away on the faces and level them up and kind of keep them in good condition so that you get a fine grind. Like right now, our next open day at the mill is going to be April 9th. It's going to be in conjunction with the River Fields Wildflower Walk. And I'll be having the mill turning, and I'll be dressing the millstones, putting a new dress on the face at that time, too. So it's kind of a rare opportunity to see a millstones being dressed by hand in person. So this is a mill, again, probably about an hour and a half outside of Greenville. And this mill, it was 1920s. There's a 1920s water wheel on it. It's in fantastic condition. There's bullet holes in it. It's got a nice little lore and history. The previous owner was a botanist at Emory University, and he was a professor of botany at Emory University, and he owned this property where he had all these ornamental trees all through the forest. It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful property, 300 and some acres, and he had a grist mill there. And this gentleman also, his passion was canoeing and whitewater rafting, and he was actually Burt Reynolds' stunt double in Deliverance. Yeah, it's kind of so it's kind of one of the it's a beautiful area again. A lot of good terrain and white water country. So, lock your doors. And this is the dressing process at Pigeon Forge. So my project base and who I work for a lot of nonprofits, historical societies, groups, museums, counties, states, the National Park Service, state parks. And I'll work for, the previous mill was owned by an individual, private owners. And then this is also a privately owned mill, but it's commercially operating too. If you go down to Pigeon Forge in Gatlinburg area, Pigeon Forge is actually named after a water-powered forge. And it's still, the remnants of that water-powered forge are actually still underneath what's now called the Old Mill of Pigeon Forge. The Old Mill of Pigeon Forge was the first electrical source for that area. The turbine that powered the generator is still in place. I've worked on it. These millstones, there's a restaurant, there's this giant restaurant right next to the old mill called the Old Mill Restaurant. And if you go in there, you have fritters, which are fantastic, cornbread, all that's ground here on these millstones. And they grind about 7,000 pounds of product a week. It's for sale all over Tennessee. And this is that dressing process. You'll see this is what's called a paint staff. And I have the greatest job in the world because I got to use finger paints during the day. And so this is tempera paint brushed on what's called a paint staff, which is a trued piece of wood. And then I brush the tempera paint on the face of the staff, and you sweep it over. It's called a rouging process. And it kind of shows the high spots of the stone. So, and it's usually the glazing is also highlighted by that process. So It's a very time-consuming endeavor, and so this is, you can kind of see how I've been slowly kind of chipping away at the face of the stone, and that's how much work I have to do. And you kind of keep going through this leveling process or this facing process until you have full paint all over the face of the stone. And so it's a set of stones to dress them by hand is about 40 hours. I use some pneumatic like carving chisels and stuff that help me kind of try to keep it down, because whether I'm building gears or water wheels or dressing millstones, I still have the same overhead. So I try to, and it's kind of with my mission, is I try to keep all this stuff in operation by kind of making it manageable for everybody. And so I come down there, they have two sets of stones that they're grinding five to 7,000 pounds of grain on every week. And about every 2 years here, I go down there because they seem to keep everything in good shape. And so this was part of the maintenance program, is to keep the stones grinding, do a fine grind, and I get feedback, you know, because they all their customers give them feedback, so I get feedback on it, which is nice. Let me see here. Okay. Yes. So there's a, you can kind of see a little handle over here, and I'm going to be showing a structure that's being built, that was built in my shop, and it's called a hearst frame. And the hearst frame, hearst is an old English word for a forest or a collection of trees, and a hearst frame is a collection of real heavy timbers. It's a substructure inside of a mill building. And what that does is isolate and dampen the vibrations from the millstones, the oscillations of the millstones and the rumble of the gears from the rest of the structure. So when these mills were built, they're always on masonry foundations. And so this hearst frame would dampen all those vibrations and isolate it from the foundations of the mill. And parts of those hearst frames are what's called a bridge tree. Every timber in a hearst frame, every timber in a mill has a name. So I'm giving you like the long explanation here. But there's beams in there called bridge trees and brayers, and it's what's collectively known as the tentering process. And what that does is the vertical drive shaft that goes up and turns the runner stone. There's a bed stone, which is stationary in a mill, in the upper runner stone. The stones rotate at 100 revolutions a minute to 120 revolutions a minute. But it pivots, it's rotated, and the drive's carried up to it by a shaft that sits in a bearing. That bearing sits on a beam that actually raises up and down. And it's pivoted on one end, and then there's usually a hand wheel. Oops. A little, oh, there we go. So there's a little hand wheel right here. You just turn the wheel. It raises one end of the beam, and then it creates a greater gap between the stones. So one of the process of the dressing process is, after you dress a set of stones, you have to balance it. The stones, the 2,000-pound stones, they're anywhere from 1,500 to 2,500 pounds. They balance on a single point, about the size of the tip of your finger, and they have to be balanced. So what they do is they plane out at that critical speed of about anywhere from 90 to 120 revolutions, and the grinding distance on say wheat is like a 16th of an inch apart. So you have these like massive pieces of stone spinning at 100 revolutions a minute, and they, you know, if you're grinding a lot of cornmeal, you can gap your stones up to an eighth of an inch, and that's about what I do when I have people in the mill, because it kind of slows down the grinding process too. It puts less load and less stress on the gear train and the components as well. But that tentering process is what kind of controls how coarse or how fine your product is. And so this is my shop. It's down on Malwood Avenue, not too far from here. After I finished my apprenticeship and I started my business, I worked out of a small building. It was more or less a barn. And then I kind of outgrew it in a few years, and I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and worked in an old steel warehouse where I had a bridge crane. It was 8,000 square. I went from like 3,000 square foot to 8,000 square foot, and had a bridge crane. That's where I worked on one of my post windmills. I could set up an entire timber frame inside, and that kind of set the precedent for me about, you know, I kind of spoiled myself. And that's kind of as I've kind of come through. So I've had shops in just outside Charlottesville, Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, Lynchburg, and now on Frankfort, corner of Frankfort and Malwood. I'm in a big industrial complex there, and I have. This is my kind of like my ultimate shop, minus the bridge crane, where I have 480 electrical. I have these old, most of my machinery dates from the 1970s or earlier. They're massive. They're 36-inch band saws. I got planers and facers for surfacing the wood. And what it is for me to operate, because I have my business. I do a lot of different things in the scope of a year, as you're seeing. I do everything from millstone dressing to design and building gear trains to installing water wheels, is that I have to be pretty fluid and dynamic on how I work. And a lot of times I have to kind of keep a real small staff. I have one person working for me, and then I have road crews that come out for the installation. And so I'll be building this usually with the help of one laborer, all this sort of stuff. And the planks and different materials, you can see some of it. The shop's much fuller now than it was back in July 2016. But a lot of the planks weigh 200 pounds. And the machines to process that are just big, heavy machines. I mean, most of my machines weigh like 6,000 pounds. So when I moved here from my last shop in Lynchburg, Virginia, it took 5 tractor trailers to move all my, and it's not that much stuff, it's just heavy. And so that's my operation, and I've kind of slowly built up what I need to operate efficiently. And again, that's why I'm able to kind of keep the cost of all these restoration projects down, because I work on a lot of governmental projects, and they'll go out to open bid, and you'll see, you know, if they don't contact me, you'll see these bids come in like 2-3 times what I would charge to do it. So I try to kind of keep everybody, all these historical projects are pulling off the same pot. I mean, preservation theory, I think everything needs to be manageable to kind of keep these things kind of moving forward. Mills specifically, water mills, how they're sited at the lowest lying areas of a stream, and the issues I have at Wolf Pin Mill and that all mills have is that they're in very prone areas. They're prone to development, runoff, flood damage, rot, decay, all these sort of things. And they, from the time I started, there's a lot of mills that, you know, were standing 20 years ago that aren't there now. And so I try to do whatever I can to, I got to make a living, but I do whatever I can to keep the cost down so that this work and these structures can be saved. Because what happens with the mills is once they cease to operate, that's when they get repurposed. They get turned into, I mean, that's great, it's preserving the structure, but that's when the machinery disappears. And that's where you're seeing some of these other projects where I'm using salvage components. Somebody turned the mill into something else and took those components out. So I reuse them and put them and kind of continue the history of those individual kind of nondescript and industrial and mechanical parts. I kind of try to find a new life for them. And so that's what the whole basis of the shop size, the fact that it's a 10,000 square foot shop and there's like 2 people working in there, but everything's huge. I mean, I fill this thing up. I actually have to, I sized my shop in layout based on the fact that I don't have to move machines. A lot of times, like I'll be building, you know, you build water wheels in half, so you have 2 25 foot diameter circles on the floor and you still have to move around. And so this whole shop, like you sketch it all out, you come up with a plan on how you're gonna bring material through. Those windmill sails that you'll see in a couple photos here, I have a 12 foot wide door, and it's right next to a building that's 40 feet away. So you have to work on you have to plan ahead. I didn't know when I moved into the space that I was gonna be working on 68 foot timbers, you know, but you just gotta kind of find a way and make it work. So I just kind of go for square footage, and it all seems to work out. Okay, so these are the new windmill sails. This is the timbers for the Danish windmill, which you saw the photos of. They're 68 foot long. This is a 53 foot tractor trailer. I'm standing on the back of the timber, which is hanging 15 feet off the back. They came from Oregon. These timbers will actually be bent. As I kind of talked about the sweep of the base of the tower, we'll set these timbers up. I'll sink anchors into the floor and put come-alongs on the end of it, and I cut this 50-foot notch into the back. That's a tooth notch. And then I inlay a 12x6 timber into the back that's 50-some feet long, and that's what holds the camber. So I'm actually making a giant relief cut along the back. And so when these things, they're all nice and straight now, there's gonna be a 12-foot sweep to them once they're done. And so they're 12x12 now. They taper out to 6x6s at the end, so it's just a giant hewing process. It's very, very labor intense. Now, this right here is the hearse frame for rock mill. It's every element, the sill, bridge tree, tie beams, stone bearers, top rail. Is it every little timber in here has a specific purpose and a specific function and a specific name. And this whole configuration, why this is the height of it and why it is the shape of it, is based off the forensics from the site, which was just cutouts in stone and a dirt floor. And that's what, you know, I could tell that the height, given the existing window openings in the side of the building, I knew what the base footprint was for the base of the structure based on the cutouts and where they quarried out the stone so it could sit level. And then there's cutouts in the ledges in the room opening that gave me an idea about where these floor distances were. And it was a really confusing, I mean, there was nothing there. There's no photographs to go off of. All I had was basically a couple window openings and some cutouts in stone. And you'll see some photos of how this project evolved. My clients are really happy with how it turned out. And so Rock Mill was, the structure that's in place there is from, I think, 1828. And what I did is used, based on elevations and distances and what was available, everything kind of told me what I needed to build. And so this is a wooden gear train. You can kind of see in here, there's two sets of 42-inch stones. There's the bed stones, there's the runner stones. I found those. I go out and I source them. They came from Virginia and Pennsylvania. I'll go out to actually do the legwork, go out, look at the stones to make sure that they're not going to blow apart when I put them back into operation. I'll dress them, I'll level them, I'll balance them, I'll change the direction of the furrow pattern in the face just to make it all usable again. And it these are actually French burr stones, and I'm not sure if you've heard of or if you're familiar with millstones, but there's a type of quartz that came over and was exported worldwide, and they came from France. So you'll have this very interesting stone composition. These are both French burrs, and one of these is a monolithic French burr, which is very rare. But these are, this is probably a 12-foot shaft. It's 14 inches across the flats. This is what holds this, the vertical shaft that goes from the water wheel area up through the cliff and into the bottom of the hearse frame. And that's the finished, it looks like a siege machine, is what one of my friends told me. It's like, thanks, let's. But this is the tenoring mechanism. So this is the hand wheel that you turn that raises this beam. The millstones sit on these two timbers here, kind of centered in between these two timbers here. The shaft kind of comes up. You turn that hand wheel, there's a rod that goes down to that bridge tree, and it raises it up and changes the distance between the stones. And this is the installation process. So we started, you know, about November with the finished windmill pictures. That was November 2015. So this is October 2016, and this is, I started the design work on this in January or February. I went up to the site and started shooting lines and elevations and different things, and this is what I kind of came up with. And so you can see there was door openings, and then there's window openings, and there's a window right here, and there's actually this leather strap for holding mill bills. Like they would store their tools there. So you knew that was at waist level. There's windows there, so you knew how to set the floor levels. And that's what dictated the hearse frame size. So this is these are the sill plates. There's actually a big radius cutout in the ledge. And that's where the vertical shafts in the previous picture actually come up from the water wheel up through the ledge. It's a lot of information to take in, I know, but it's it's a lot to figure out too. But you know, it was interesting because I had variations in window levels, and what I kind of conceived was that they had landings on each end of the hearse frame. And it's really, there we go, I like that, huh? So this is the kind of the finished product here. This is all this was built, basically everything here was built in Louisville over the past year. And these are the landings I'm talking about. You can see a window opening here, a window opening here, that tool strap for storing mill bills. This is the hoppers that hold the grain, the casings that go around the millstones, the tenoring hand wheels. And these are the little ladders that kind of allow you to go from landing floor down to the stone floor. And that's December 2016. And in November of last year, I guess based on some movement out at the Danish windmill, they asked me to come out. They received an emergency grant to take the sails down because there was such things were shifting around that it was causing some alarm. So they received an emergency grant to have the mill stabilized, have the sails taken down so they don't fall down. And so they asked me to come out there. They said, well, you just have to, this is November. They're like, you just have to, just have to start work by the end of the year. I'm like, okay, that's not an issue. So my parents actually live an hour away from here. So we were planning to go out. My wife, daughter, and I were going to go out and see my parents for Christmas anyway. And so December 27th, I started taking the windmill apart. So this is what kind of started me 21 years ago, and this is kind of where I've ended up. Another interesting thing about this windmill is that when it was in Norsnee, Denmark, it ground for the Kelsen. I'm not sure what it was called back then, but it was basically the Kelsen Bakery. And if you've ever had like the butter cookies, like if you go to like Walgreens or CVS and you get those tins of butter cookies, there's like five different shapes. They all taste the same in their little paper cups.
Yeah.
That's the Kelsen Company. This windmill, when it was in Denmark, used to ground all the flour for the Kelsen Company. And then when it left, the odd thing now is that Kelsen is owned by Campbell's, and Campbell's is in Omaha. So a lot of those cookies and different things are actually made in Omaha, like an hour away. So it's so when when we started the project, they were fundraising, and they asked me to. They had a Kelsen cookie tin, and I was taking nuts and bolts off of the sales. They're like, "Hey, throw these in the Kelsen cookie tin." So like, after the money. So that's kind of where my year ends in terms of projects, and kind of where I've kind of shifted from, you know, when I was starting out really my career, and I just really wanted to learn as much as possible about this. It's such a vast subject and a vast skill level to pick up. Like really for the first like 15 years, I was just like locked into learning as much as I can and all the different processes and all working all the different mills. And I think probably after my daughter was born, I took the shift and to, I guess, share, I would not consult in projects. I would just say, you know, I'll come work on your mill, but I won't consult. And all that took a big shift in my career. And that's one of the reasons we came out here too, is to kind of share the story of mills and their preservation and the education. I really think there's such great educational tools. They teach you about physics, they teach you about mechanics, they teach you about history, they teach you about community, they teach you about agriculture. It's such a great teaching tool. And that's where I've kind of I've gotten to. Like this is my daughter right here. She's there with our friend Gina's sons. And there they are helping me turn the windmill in. This is the what's called the tail wheel, that's the tail pole. And so there's a little lever that raises up that staircase. You lock it into place, and then you just push the wheel around. And really, I would say like 3, 10, or 12-year-olds can actually push that whole structure around. So I wasn't getting a lot of help there. I did a 360 for them, so it was kind of a workout. But that's pretty much it. And this is what we're doing in April, and again in May. We haven't set May dates for open days at the mill, but it's going to be towards the tail end of the month. We've opened up for the communities. We've had some JCPS classes kind of come out. Thank you. And we're just slowly evolving our program kind of organically and seeing what really works and what fits on the land. Our access to the farm is we just can't have a lot of people out there at any given time. We don't have a big parking lot. If we have a bus come out, it's got to park like, you know, half a mile away at least, and everybody's got to walk down. So we kind of keep our group small, and we're slowly building this program to kind of share the history and the story of the mill with the community. So this is just one of a couple of our events, and it's something that we're kind of looking forward to continuing. Thank you. All right. Does anybody have any questions? I'm not sure if I've run later. Yes?
Could you tell that story? I heard you tell part of it before about the big white oaks that you got in
Brown. Oh, okay. So I work with a lot of specialty companies, usually loggers. Like I usually find logs and then find somebody to saw them for me for a specific project. Let's see if I can pull a slide up and you can actually see it. At the flume, I don't think we're gonna have it pull up here, but the flume is the structure that carries the water from the ground level out to the top of the wheel. That's a built structure. At Wolfpin Mill, that flume is 32 feet long. It's basically 2 feet square, and it's made out of 3-inch wide planks. The bottom board is 24 inches wide, and the sideboards are 18 inches deep. And the configuration of the flume is basically to support its own weight and to support the weight of the water. And that's why it's sized the way it is, because we don't have 18 inches of water flowing out there. It's just more for its own structure. And this whole flume, which is 32 feet long, was all constructed out of one log that was cleared for development in Westchester County, New York. I was told it was a one log load for a tractor trailer. So the tree was so massive that they could probably weigh 40,000 pounds or 50,000 pounds, which is all it could carry. And so I work with a lot of yards that supply the shipbuilders and boat restoration in New England, and that's where this came from. So the materials that went into the flume at Wolfpin also went into, it actually went into a tall ship restoration too. I didn't get the whole thing. That's how big that tree was, is that I got all, everything I needed for the flume, all the frames, all came out of part of one tree. So it's just good to know the right people and, you know, put it to good use. Yes, sir.
Are you now working on any mill projects in Kentucky other than
Wolfpin? So I have a project coming up that's a new old mill. It's going to be out in Shelby County, and it's for a distillery. And so what the premise is out there is there's a huge history tie to this distillery that's being built. I mean, it's a lot about the early settlers in the area, and I have a friend that had a business, and he would restore antique log cabins, and he was disabled, so he had a series of cabins available for this project. And we're taking those cabins that were actually built in Pennsylvania, and then we're going to turn one into a grist mill and the other into a tasting room. So that's my story right now for Kentucky Mills, is we're actually building a new mill for Kentucky. It's gonna have a 15-foot by 3-foot water wheel, one set of stones, and the configuration is gonna be such that people can just walk in, see, similar to what we had out in Missouri, where it's going to be an educational exhibit, where it's going to be grinding, fully functional, but you don't have to climb through different levels to see it all operate. You get to see all the gravity flow of the grain, and grain going one end and cornmeal kind of come out the other.
Water powered.
Yes, sir.
Is the mill, I'm not sure exactly where it is, do you have a website we can go to?
If you visit the Riverfields website, they have a wildfire walk, and that's advertised. And we don't have a site for the mill yet. I think that's something that we're going to, once we kind of figure out how we're going to bring people in and figure out the liability issues and that sort of stuff. But right now we're kind of operating through other groups to bring in visitors. So if I can broadcast to Mary Beth too, our open days, and then you're welcome to come out. Yeah, you're welcome to come out.
Can't ride down Fourth Bend Ranch Road.
No, we try to. it's back, and it's really unique in that it's in a very natural environment where we don't have electricity there, and that's one of the things that I did is to bring groups in. We attached an alternator and some batteries and put lights in there so people can kind of come in. But the circuits that power the lights only operate when the water wheel's turning. So like when the kids kind of come out, you know, you have to say, okay, you got to wait. The wheel's got to start. Watch the wheel start out. Then you can come in and see the lights are powered by the water wheel.
I thought you lived there.
Oh, I do. Not at the mill. I live on the farm.
On the farm.
On the farm.
Well,
then we have the Cooper family right here. So, yeah, this is the Eva Cooper. So the mill was, or the what's now Wolfpin Mill Farm, was assembled or put together by Eva Lee Cooper in the 1920s, and she bought several parcels of land in the mill and created a farm. I think it was 200 and some acres or so originally. And then in the 1980s, Sally Bingham bought the Cooper Farm, and then an adjacent farm, and now it's 430 acres. So that's the expanse of it. It's a very, I mean, there's a lot of history associated with the property, but the terrain itself is just incredible because you have Wolfpin that emerges, seeps up out of the ground around the interstate and up around Cabela's and Norton Commons, and it flows, two-thirds of Wolfpin flow on the farm, and then it empties into Harris Creek, which is the other boundary of the farm as well.
Have you ever heard of Kugler's Mill Road in Cincinnati, northeast Cincinnati?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't spent much time in Cincinnati. Okay.
I was hoping because that's our last name.
Okay.
And there's mills all down through the family.
It's all tied to the geography too, because the mills are so tied to the terrain that's why you see a lot of mill roads. I mean, if you follow those roads and go down to the lowest lying area or lowest lying stretch along that road, you find a mill site. So, any other questions? Well, thank you all for... Yes, sir.
The stones, are they quartz or granite?
They vary in composition. Thank you. They vary in composition. There's domestic quarries they'd use for a lot of corn grinding. They'd use a local stone. And then for their wheat grinding, they would usually use a granite, like a harder stone, or this freshwater quartz, this French burr stone. So, okay, thank you, thank you.
Yeah.
All right.